Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
John Froh.
And John, it's lovely to see you. We were just reminiscing about perhaps the last time that we spoke. It was certainly many years ago. And it's good to see that you've got, unlike me, a real background, and it has books and magazines and chairs and pictures and things like that. But I wanted to start off by asking you if you would share with us what's currently dynamizing, preoccupying, interesting, retarding you. What's happening?
Okay, big question.
Yes. Your starter for 10.
Yeah, so it's probably easiest if I talk about the research that I'm currently doing. I mean, what's preoccupying me at the moment, because I've just been watching the news, is the situation in Gaza and the uncontainable sense of frustration that, like many people, I feel about that. My research, however, so the last book I published was called On Interpretive Conflict. It came out with Chicago in 2019. It's about a series of institutions of interpretation. Since then, I've been writing a book on value, by which I mean economic value, not the kinds of values that have preoccupied me for most of my career. What I'm doing is engaging on the one hand with anthropological theories of valuation, and the work of the STS people, Michel Calon in particular, on markets and the interpretive cultures that inform markets, as well as engaging with the most recent work of Luc Boltanski, called Enrichment, which is a fantastic book, which I found said much of what I wanted to say, and I had to sort of work my way around that. But I'm also engaging with the Marxist tradition, which I came out of in both senses of the word many decades ago. I spent my 70s, the decade of the 70s, sitting in libraries, reading Marx in German, trying to come to terms with Marx, trying to, in a way, rewrite, reformulate the Marxist tradition to my purposes. So my first book, Marxism and Literary History, was very much an attempt to use a kind of Althusserian Marxism to rethink literary studies. So this book on value, it's sort of finished and sort of not. What I'm exploring, apart from that anthropological tradition and the Marxist tradition, is the areas of social production, which I think pose a challenge for traditional theories of values. So, in particular, the digital economy, and the marketization of the natural world. So, I'm looking at carbon credits and carbon offset systems, for example, and the markets sort of developed in those things. The book, I sent the book off to a publisher a few months ago, got a very, very positive review back. The person really liked the book, apart from the chapter on Marx, which he said was crap. And on reflection, I had to realize that it was in fact crap, that I had a great deal more work to do, that I was making judgments about Marx without ever having properly read volume three of Capital. So what I've done now is I've gone back and read the three volumes of Capital, including volume two, which nobody reads, and various other Marxist texts, and a vast array of commentaries, particularly Moshe Postone, Isaac Rubin, Diane Elson, and a bunch of contemporary Marxist theorists. So that's what I'm doing at the moment. I'm trying to write my Marx chapter, trying to get my head around the mind-bending complexities of some of the more detailed bits of Marx, in particular the transformation problem. That'll do.
That's quite a lot. I wonder if you could tell us more about this question in general of your pathway into Marxism and out of it that you alluded to. What drew you to it? What took you out of it, and what is dragging you back? Which tentacles are reaching out from the from Carlito?
Carolito, indeed. Okay, so I came of age in the 1960s. I was at university from 66 to 68. That was a time of considerable radicalization, particularly around the Vietnam War. I was a an objector to the conscription, and if my number had come up, I would have had to go to prison for a couple of years. More importantly, when I left Australia in 1970, I lived in Buenos Aires for a year and then traveled through South America for another about 9 months. And that profoundly radicalized me because I saw what the Third World was like and saw what American imperialism had done in Latin America. So by the time I rocked up to Cornell University in 1970, late 1971, I was strongly Marxist and strongly revolutionary in my views. And Cornell itself was, if not a hotbed of radicalism, at least it was, you know, it still had the afterglow of the 1960s. It was still, there were still demonstrations against the Vietnam War and so on. While I was in Buenos Aires, I married an Indian woman, and so I spent subsequently a lot of time in India, which similarly sensitized me to the Third World, to all of the meanings of imperialism and post-imperialism in a Third World context. So that's where my reading of Marx came from. In 1973 and 74, I was an exchange student at Heidelberg. So I sat in the library in Heidelberg and read Marx in German and read the Frankfurt School and just immersed myself in Marx's theory and then wrote, you know, this abstruse PhD thesis, which was very, very centrally about Marxism. I suppose Althusser was the other major discovery that I made while I was at Cornell. So that was my way into Marxism. If there's one moment when I came out of it, it was 1989 when I heard on television people in East Germany and Eastern Europe denouncing Marxism as a tool of oppression, which of course it had been for many decades. It was at that point that I thought I can't call myself a Marxist anymore. And in that, you know, in that intervening period, in any case, I'd become more skeptical about the more orthodox forms of Marxism. And so my reading of Foucault, which was absolutely crucial to my intellectual formation, was what drew me away from Marxism. But having said that, all of my books are built out of and engage with central Marxist concepts like ideology and class in cultural studies and cultural value. I talk quite a bit of, I try, you know, being a modest soul, I try and reinvent class theory as I have just reinvented Marxism. And the commodity form in time and commodity culture. So I've never stopped engaging with the Marxist tradition, but I don't see it as a source of sort of radical energy anymore. Although I still, you know, I still would define myself as working in some sense within that tradition.
Sorry, the podcat is intervening here, as John can see.
That's a very fine cat.
I've only recently learnt, John, that 80% of ginger cats are male. There's some
All
sort of weird genetic thing. Anyway, I think this means that we can keep talking.
You could chuck her in that ocean behind you there.
Yes,
But
the
again, sorry, again.
well-known ocean surrounding Madrid. So we'll keep talking, but I may have to make a small intervention in terms of giving him some more food.
Sure.
So I think that's an interesting set of remarks, John. I guess there is a tradition, of course, of analytic Marxism, which seeks to disarticulate it from the political project. And for many of us, what happened in 89 was wonderful and not a disappointment or a disillusion, because we never thought that these regimes were doing other than using Marxism as a tool of oppression. And that there
Yeah.
was no
Oh, of course.
necessary, if I can use old-fashioned language, no necessary correspondence between Marxism and what went on in Eastern and Central Europe. But I guess what you're saying is that for you there was, and that this was a great moment of disillusionment. Have I got that right? Or
Yeah.
what do you think of
Well,
my
sort of, yeah. I mean,
justification of
it's a contingent connection. Yes, of course, I'd never had any brief for the Soviet regime, and I'd never thought that the Marxism that was a state ideology had anything to do with the Marx that I had read. So it was really just about the label. It was about the impossibility of not seeing Marxism as having been used as a tool of repression.
And can I ask about the Foucault influence? Because for many of us, books like Discipline and Punish are Marxist works. And politically, it's clear that the influence of Sartre against colonialism was immense, even though there was clearly a rejection of the humanistic notion of the core of Sartre's philosophy and literature. And so I get, and of course, he taught with Althusser, Foucault, and there's a moment where he says there is something of Althusser in my books. And so this opposition that I guess you're drawing, and many folks do, between Foucault and Marx, I don't really see. I mean, what I do see is a rejection of ideology critique in Foucault.
I mean, yes, of course, Foucault's always very generous in his public statements about Marx, but I do think he withdraws from many of the central explanatory categories of Marxism. I mean, he does that in Les Mots et les Choses, where he talks about value theory having been rooted in humanism, something with which I deeply agree. And I think much of his later political writing, particularly the first volume of The History of Sexuality, was an attempt to formulate alternative models of power to the models that were prevalent in France. And of course, Foucault is also reacting against the hegemony of the French Communist Party in French
Yes,
intellectual life.
sure. I am on Sunday, John. I stood in front of Las Meninas in the Prado, and I hadn't quite realized that it's like the Mona Lisa. I mean, people just gather in their thousands every day to stare at this thing. And I couldn't help thinking, because supposedly in 1966, in the summer, people fleeing Paris for the beach, everyone was reading Les Mots et les Choses, or claiming to, right? 100,000 copies sold and so on. I kept looking at all these folks who clearly phenotypically came from all over the world, thinking, how many of you read that damn thing? Is that why you're here? And what are you seeing? Because, of course, they've got a vast array of Velázquez paintings there. And you can see, ele I don't know which comes first. Historically, I don't know enough about the dating of the pictures, but you can see either echoes or preliminary versions of what clearly drew Foucault's attention in that astonishing work. Really amazing. And yes, I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate it. But you keep being drawn back. This is not one of these conversions, where there's a God that's failed and must now be damned forever. This is
No.
rather one of these moments when it's there within you and you're always engaging with it. And so back to value.
Yeah.
And I wonder if on that score, John, I could ask you a couple of questions about what you think was wrong in that draft chapter that the reader didn't like, and what you've discovered as you've gone back into reading Capital.
Oh, what was wrong was just a certain glibness and a reliance on old memories rather than direct textual engagement. And yeah, just some glib judgments and a rather too glib condemnation of the labor theory of value, which is actually extremely complex, and I'm still struggling with it. My task at the moment is just to write an exposition of Marxist theory, which is reasonably faithful, and then tease out the problems that I see with it. And they're not even necessarily problems, but what I'm trying to do is ultimately connect questions of economic value with questions of social value, social, aesthetic, whatever. And I'll do it through the apparatus that I've developed over many years, that is thinking in terms of institutional structures, thinking in terms of regimes or orders of worth, which organize evaluation. And my reading of Marx really centers on the fact that value, and in particular the value of labor, is never given in the commodity. It's only ever nachträglich. It's only ever realized in the market, in market exchange. So we don't know. I mean, that, and the fact that value is constantly on the move. It doesn't stay still. So there is no fixed value. Commodities certainly don't have a fixed value. Labor doesn't have a fixed value. Those things, and Marx is quite explicit about it, are realized subsequently in the circulation process, and in particular in exchange, that is in the market. So my goal is to link up those forms of evaluation, those forms by which we assess the worth of a commodity or the worth of labor. To match that up with the other stuff that I'm doing on markets as systems of evaluation. So it's not really all that far away from my work in cultural studies, which has been very centrally concerned with the systems through which we come to terms with the world through evaluative regimes, or discursive regimes.
And where does the fetish come in there? Because I guess one of Marx's ideas is that our ability to track the life of a commodity sign as consumers or workers or users is deeply limited, particularly in our role as consumers, because we don't know the labor process or the environmental impact or even the prehistory in any sense of the commodities we have. How much do you and I know about the commodities that are surrounding us now that are enabling us to talk in terms of their histories? That these are fetishized away through exchange value. So is the fetish, is there going to be an entry under F in the index, or is it not there?
Well, possibly. I mean, it's a concept that I've never particularly liked, but it actually is absolutely central to the epistemology of Das Kapital, because it's all about the way the forms of thought of bourgeois society produce a common sense, which is the common sense that profit comes out of capital investment and the cost of production. The common sense that class relations are not deeply embedded in commodity production. So it's a very powerful theory of everyday knowledge, of the forms of everyday knowledge which obscure underlying relations. Now, of course, that always raises the problem of, the surface depth metaphor and how seriously we're to take that. I'm not sure I have an answer to that, but yeah,
But
there may well be an
you said when
under-F.
you first answered that you'd never liked the concept.
I'm sort of struggling to remember why I didn't like it. It had to do with the Althusserian problematic that I was engaged in, and I think it had to do with Althusser's critique of empiricism, which he says finds meaning embedded in the world itself. Finds its analytic procedures already existing in the reality which it's analyzing. And the concept of the fetish always seemed to me to be doing something like that. But I think I can get past that now.
Was it John Docker, somebody like that? Somebody wrote a piece called, I think Docker wrote I Was a Teenage Leavesite, but didn't somebody write I Was a Teenage Althusserian? Somebody
Possibly,
suffered must
I don't know.
have. Yes. No, very, very interesting. And I think that's going to be important work. In terms of anthropological theories of value, of course, a lot of those are deeply influenced by Marxism, whilst some steer some distance from it. The sort of Latour disciples and followers or collaborators seem to set themselves against Marxism, as do many followers of Foucault, in ways that I never find terribly compelling, because when I read Latour, I read a critique of a kind of mechanistic Marxism, but I've never read a more materialist account of something.
Yes, no, I agree. And again, I think it's very much bound up with the French intellectual scene and the remnants of communist ideology as a force in that scene. But yeah, in a sense, it's stupid to quibble about labels. Yeah, Latour and Calon both do, I think, really interesting materialist analyses of the world.
No, absolutely, and I think that was great. I wonder if I could cast you back almost 40 years though, John, to Marxism and literary history, which remains an important point of reference for many of us. And obviously you feel as though there are some things there that you would no longer subscribe to, but what were you trying to get at? What were you trying to do? And what do you think you did?
A couple of different things. First of all, develop a non-representational or non-representationist account of literary representation. So using the Althusserian, Machiavellian notion that literary texts work not upon the real but upon representations of the real. They work on ideology, they work on discourse, rather than directly engaging with the real. The real disappears in that formulation. All that survives are ideological representations of it, and then the working of those representations by literary texts or philosophical texts. So that was one part of it. The second was trying to develop an account of the literary system, trying to think in an analytic way about all the institutional underpinnings of the literary. So this was partly a deconstruction of the concept of the literary. I can't claim any originality for that. Everybody was doing it in those days. But trying to use Russian formalism in particular to develop an alternative account of the literary system and how it works, the temporality of the literary, and indeed historical temporality in general as a cross-section of multiple different temporalities, the temporalities of different systems, the temporality of everyday life, of economics, of history, of the literary, developing at their own speed and their own way, but obviously constantly intersecting with other temporalities. So that joint notion of system and process, of systems in process, systems made up of multiple temporalities, was central to what I was doing.
And how and where and why and to what effect does cultural studies enter your world of research, John?
The other thing I was doing in Marxism and literary history was trying to kill Lukács, but I'm not sure I succeeded. Cultural studies. I was reading the early, the Xeroxed off-prints from the Birmingham Centre while I was at Cornell in the early 70s, and had in fact planned to go to Birmingham. My partner, my wife, was planning to study there until I got offered a job at Murdoch, which we took instead because we had no visible means of support. The cultural studies meshed with the kind of, or at least my version of cultural studies meshed with the work I was doing on institutions, on the systems that underpin everyday life. I didn't see a great deal of difference between the work that Stuart Hall and his collaborators were doing and the work that I was doing. Within Marxism, Hall, of course, was engaging with the same theorists I was engaging with Althusser in particular. So there was that kind of affinity. And then when I got to Murdoch, there were other people there interested in cultural studies. So it gradually formed as a, I think, an important little cluster within Australian cultural studies.
And could you tell us a little bit about what it was like going to a new university, having been at a very established one in Cornell, albeit an unusual one in that Cornell is an Ivy League but also quasi-public university, and then going to somewhere that has no such status, no such history, and was one of these things set up as a project at a time of Keynesian expansionism that came into reality at a time of monetarist restriction, should we say?
It was great. Because I got there in the first year that Murdoch was set up, which meant we had a whole curriculum to invent, and we could do it as we saw fit. We weren't constrained by the traditional disciplines, except insofar as we wanted to be constrained. So there was an enormous freedom. That and the fact that the university was so small that we talked to people in other disciplines, even to scientists. We had friends and acquaintances right across the disciplinary spectrum. So it was a genuinely interdisciplinary place. We were engaging with each other's work quite substantially. And because I was writing up courses for external students as well as for internal students, I was actually doing a lot of writing of my lectures, not just writing lecture notes. So that was actually useful for getting books written because I used those things as sounding boards. I mean, I imagine the stuff I wrote then was far too abstruse and difficult for an undergraduate audience. And I did have to learn to give a lecture that wasn't way above the heads of my students, but I sort of got there, sort of.
And
When were you there, Toby?
I
Which year?
arrived in the summer of 1986, so the beginning of 1986, which is, I think, when you and I first met, and probably around the time that your Marxism and Literary History book appeared. So I got to know many of the people that you knew, and among them, Horst Rutroff became my doctoral advisor, and that was very fortunate. Tom O'Regan was jointly the doctoral advisor. Tom now sadly passed away, but Horst's still kicking. In fact, I get information from the philosophy seminar at Murdoch, and he's still, charging into battle about Frege.
And producing vast tomes on Kant, yeah.
And dealing, as he puts it, with the Husserl mafia. So, yes, and Horst was a very big influence on me, and continues to be. So, I think I'm right in saying that you're there for quite a long time, and then you go to Queensland, is that right? University
Yes,
of.
I went to Murdoch University in Western Australia in 75. I went to Queensland at the end of 89.
End of 89.
Sorry.
So, and this is to a much more established university, a famous Australian university.
Yeah.
Each of the Australian states has a sort of traditional, I think they're called the Sandstone Six, is that right, Prof? Has these very established 19th century edifices that remain the jewels in their incrustation. And that was true of the University of Queensland. So, what was it like going, having jumped from a very established, famous school in Cornell to this exciting, emergent place that then, I guess, probably gets a bit more institutionalized over the decade and more that you're there, and then on
Yeah.
to this comparatively gigantic thing in the University of Queensland and to English, having been in English and comparative literature. Quite a radical interdisciplinary formation into an English department that was deemed quite traditional in certain ways, I would say.
It was, but it also had its own radical traditions. There were people there like Dan O'Neill and Carol Ferrier who were,
Yes.
strong Marxists. I came in as not just a chair, but as chair of the department. And this was just at the point when the Dawkins reforms were starting to bite. So I had to do things like produce a workload formula, which was anathema to the department. They'd never had a workload formula. That people did what they were told or did what they felt like doing. God knows what they did. But things like that, having to do restrictive budgets, having to implement appraisals of academic staff in which they were asked about their research. There were some people there who had never done any research. So that came as a shock. And I was mired in some really horrendous battles with the department. I had my supporters and I had my opponents. I was What was really great was that Graham Turner went to UQ at the same time I did, and he was a really solid ally and probably somebody who had his had connections with the department that were more friendly than mine. Mine were a bit abstracted and hostile in many cases. So it was an interesting time. I mean, one of the things that Graham and I did was set up a cultural studies program within the English department. And the department itself wasn't particularly conservative in terms of its curriculum. So I was able to do, I mean, I was able to teach theory subjects as well as cultural studies subjects. The conservatism of the discipline wasn't really a problem, but the state of the university post Dawkins
Right,
was a
the
problem.
sort of political economy of accountability. And just to give some context for those who won't have heard of these things, John slash Joe Dawkins, I guess he's still alive probably,
I
was
think so, yeah.
Member of Parliament for Fremantle, where both John and I lived in Perth, who was finance minister, I think, in a supposedly social democratic socialist government.
I can't
And
remember.
yeah, something anyway, and perhaps education minister, perhaps that's when it all happened. And he decided that he would democratize higher education by trying to allegedly break down the barriers of class between these Sandstone Six schools that we were speaking about and the rest of the system. Of course, all this did was instantiate more class privilege. while making life hell for people who didn't have PhDs and were never expected to do research and so on, and introduced this system of accountability, so-called, that included much more surveillance of people. And Megan Morris has written very movingly about this, about how, when she was an undergrad, there were these guys who were just drunk and not trying very hard and not doing much. But the other side to that was the wonder of it. People like the radicals that you mentioned earlier. People like Dan O'Neill. And
Well, Dan O'Neill is a good example. He never published anything, as far as I know, but he was an incredibly intelligent, well-read person, gave inspiring lectures, just never published anything. So he really didn't fit into the new system.
exactly. And of course, when you're put in a position institutionally where you're required to animate this new method, you get a lot of the flak, regardless of your other positive or negative aspects, right? So I think it's worth explaining that to people, because if you've never been head of a department when there is this remarkable transformation, it's really a thing. And I guess the other thing I want to mention, John, is that when I look back at the places where I've taught, I see in all the countries where I'm teaching this tendency becoming stronger and stronger, based on a fundamental mistrust of academics, that we're somehow or other gaming things, that we're not really committed, that we're just there to do whatever we feel like, and that is just increasing in its influence all the time. And now it's just internalized by people who don't even object to it. Whereas you and I were fortunate enough to have lived in a time when we were trusted.
And we had a more or less collegial system of university governance, which wasn't perfect. I mean, it was a system that had God professors in it.
Yes.
So
Not
it's
pointing at any at
important
Murdoch University, of course.
not God. It's important not to idealize those days.
Yes.
Nevertheless, there was a great deal more input into the governance of the university on the part of academics than there is now. I mean, what Dawkins did was he turned the university system into a mass education system, which in many ways was admirable, but the funding never followed. He set up a funding system, the HECS system, which was contingent on later income. So you paid back your student debt through the taxation system, which was, in a sense, a quite clever design. The one flaw that it had was that later politicians could always adjust the rates of repayment. So the Howard government, in particular, just ratcheted up the HECS system so that it was much more expensive than it was ever meant to be. But it's a problem. I mean, our society wants a mass tertiary education system, but it's not prepared to pay for it, and it's not prepared to impose the taxes that would pay for it.
Now, John, around this time, you get involved in a collaborative, quite empirical research project with the late lamented Michael Emerson, a wonderful person, and Tony. And was there someone else, or was it the three of
It
you?
was basically the three of us. There were other collaborators.
Okay.
In
And
particular, the people who taught me how to read numbers. So that was when I was at the University of Queensland, Tony Bennett was at the University of Queensland, sorry, at Griffith University. We both had read and admired the work of Pierre Bourdieu. And I suggested one day that we should do an Australian study that would reproduce Bourdieu's work for Australia. That is a large-scale survey-based analysis of Australian cultural preferences and practices. So, as it turned out, of course, it was a vast project. It took about 7 or 8 years to do. We had a number of large grants to do it. We interviewed about 2,500 people eventually, with a very elaborate questionnaire. It was interesting. I mean, I wouldn't ever want to do that kind of empirical research again. And I would, and it was extremely difficult for me to get my head around the statistical analysis involved, but I eventually got quite creative with it, and found it very satisfying. And, you know, I think it produced quite important results with, you know, for the Australian system. I mean, it was quite, we were actually quite critical of Bourdieu in a number of ways. So it wasn't just applying Bourdieu, it was also updating and criticizing Bourdieu's methodology. But, you know, his work is still incredibly sophisticated and penetrating.
And it's a bit after that, am I right in saying this, that there's a run of books in the early 2000s, which maybe you did work for partly in Queensland, partly at Edinburgh, partly in Melbourne. There's a book about genre. There's a book about character. There's a book about time. There's a book about cultural studies and value. I may be conflating a few times.
Those last two are in the 90s.
Oh, in the
Cultural study,
90s.
cultural value is 95, maybe. Time and commodity culture 97. So yeah, genre came out in maybe 2003, something like that. And then a collection of essays about 10 years after that, and a book on character in 2014.
So the genre book, then you're in Edinburgh, perhaps.
Yeah.
What was it like going to another, even older institution, very renowned, and in a different political and cultural environment?
It was difficult. So I had thought, because there had just been a devolution of power to the Scottish Parliament, I had assumed that Scotland was going to be an intellectual hotbed. I thought it was going to be intellectually very exciting. In fact, it wasn't. I found the politics quite narrow, quite nationalistic. Edinburgh, I think they hired me because of my CV, because of my publications, for the research exercise that they have to do. So I didn't particularly fit in there. And what I did was I stepped sideways into IASH, the Institute for Advanced Studies in the Humanities at Edinburgh, which that allowed me to reach out around the university rather than being confined within the English department. And look, my move to Edinburgh coincided with the breakup of my long-term marriage. It was all messy and difficult, and I wasn't particularly happy. But on the other hand, Edinburgh was a fantastic place to live. It was close to Europe. And I did start getting things done intellectually again.
And the genre book is an important intervention. Genre is one of the really most interesting concepts, both etymologically and politically, that circles around the humanities and somehow seems to have dropped a bit out of favor as a concept. I don't read so much about it. Tell us what your take is on it's what it means and what its significance is.
Yeah. Okay, so I was invited to write the book by John Drakakis, who was at Stirling University, and he knew my work well enough to know that genre was actually a very central concept, particularly in Marxism and literary history. So I treat genre as a social category. It's one of the ways in which social norms are brought to bear upon our practice of reading. So the book is directed against those taxonomic theories of genre, which think it's about classification. It's more about lay systems of classification and how we ne negotiate them, how we make sense of particular literary genres and the worlds that they're representing. But more generally, it's a sort of an epistemological argument about the way our reality is constructed through systems like generic systems through which we work out the values that we bring to whatever practices we're engaged in.
And I've got two more questions for you, if I may, Prof. And then to conclude, I'd like to throw it open to you to add anything you may wish. You might want to add something to what you've already mentioned or introduce something entirely new. Does that sound okay as a means of concluding?
Yep, sure.
So, first question is about the institutions of interpretation, which is this, I think, 2019 book. And obviously touches on topics that have been important to your work going far back. What are these institutions of interpretation?
So there are four case studies in the book. Let me see if I can remember them. One is the law. So I talk about the institution of the law through a reading of the Heller case, which is the case in which American gun control law, gun control is the wrong word, gun rights are established as established fact by juridical interpretation. Using a methodology which is supposedly faithful to the text of the Constitution. In fact, it's not. It's demonstrably politically oriented. It's demonstrably responding to the pressures from the NRA, responding to a whole bunch of social pressures. So I read that case, the judgment in the Heller case, through the claims that that the Supreme Court makes about its methodology, and then I test that out against other conflicting possibilities of interpretation. But what I'm interested in getting at is the law itself as a as an interpretive system. So it's not particularly about particular men doing particular interpretations. It's about the knowledge that they have, the ways in which they're constrained institutionally, the responsibility that they feel they have, and all the apparatus of the law, including the repressive apparatus, and all the paraphernalia that goes with it. So that was one case study. Another is of the museum, sorry, the art museum. Talk about iconoclasm in particular as being constitutive of the museum, constitutive of the history of the museum. Talk about the history of iconoclasm in some depth, and try to talk about the ways in which art history, art interpretation is guided by that history and by its embedding within the art museum. Third case study is theatre. I do a reading of The Merchant of Venice through the history of its stagings from whenever late 17th century through to sorry late 16th century through to the present. A history of often quite radically different interpretations, which of course then intersects with the history of anti-Semitism and shapes it quite profoundly. And I wonder what my fourth case study was.
It's climate change.
Climate change, yes. A subject which is dear to my heart. So I did a huge amount of work on the analysis of climate change. So it's not about the chapter's not about climate change as such, it's about the methodologies used to establish our understanding of the way climate change is affecting the world. So in a way it's unpicking, undoing those complex computer modeling systems and their claims to truth, but at the same time I'm trying to say this is the best truth that we have. There are no better truths. And conversely, I talk about the way companies like Exxon worked for many years to project a counter reality.
And I should say that Uli was asking about institutions of interpretation. Of course, it's actually got a different title. It's on interpretive conflict.
Conflict, yeah.
But looking at the institutions that engage in conflictual understandings of key social issues, and a
Yeah.
wonderful book. So my last question before throwing to you to finish things, John, is to actually go back to your opening remarks, although this touches on what you've just said, and to ask you about the climate catastrophe, global heating, climate change question today, and what this suggests for people interested in culture.
Well, that's a hard question. I have to say I'm deeply pessimistic about global heating. I don't think there's any way back from where we're going. I think the world is moving inexorably towards a climate which is going to be close to unsustainable for human life. In a way, it seems trivial to talk about culture in relation to that kind of catastrophe. But of course, culture is about the ways in which we understand events, including catastrophic events. So, yes, there are still battles to be fought about the politics of climate heating. There are battles to be fought about the understanding of climate heating and about the obfuscations being perpetrated by climate denialists, which I think still are largely the prevalent way of thinking about climate change, i.e., either it doesn't matter or it's too late to do anything about it. And in any case, we're not responsible. So those are political struggles. And they have cultural elements embedded in them. And that's why I thought a case study of climate change methodology was appropriate for a book about interpretation.
Well, thank you very much, John, and I'm just wondering if there is anything you'd like to add.
God, where do I start? So let me just say a few words about cultural studies. I mean, I've always had a sort of ambivalent relationship with cultural studies. I think of myself these days as primarily a literary scholar, although I don't think I will write any more books of literary scholarship. My interventions in cultural studies have been shaped by that formative experience at Murdoch University, also perhaps with my association with people like Leslie Stern and Megan Morris. I think I'm probably now fairly pessimistic about cultural studies as a discipline. I don't like the way it's evolved. I don't like the American form of cultural studies, which is strongly identity-based. I think the kinds of things that preoccupy me, that is, questions of institutions, questions of regimes, of orders of worth, questions of the social structures that shape cultures, shape understanding, are no longer central to mainstream cultural studies. So that's a disappointment, but you do what you can and you move on. What about you? How do you feel about the discipline? Because you come at it from an obtuse angle as well.
Yes. I'm always embarrassed here in Spain when I'm introduced to people as this is Toby Miller. He does cultural studies. Rather like what my experience when I lived in LA for many years, and my friends in the film industry would introduce me as this is Toby Miller. He's a socialist. And as you know, living in the United States, it's very complicated to speak truthfully about politics because it is such a binary and parliamentary based system, apart from the massive third sector extra institutional elements. But I don't like being positioned as a spokesperson for cultural studies, as is sometimes the case here. But I worry very much that there has been a marginalization of political economic approaches within much of cultural studies, that there has been what Terry Eagleton rather unkindly referred to 40 years ago as the Reader's Liberation Movement. I think there's a little piece he wrote in New Literary History to that effect. I'm much more taken by, Tony's idea of reading formations, for example, by Roger Chartier's work on the circulation of things. And I worry that there is a lack of the sort of serious reading that you were laying out for us when you talked about life in Germany and life at Cornell. In other words, people know that there was this, that Althusser was surpassed by Gramsci, who was surpassed by Foucault. And it's not clear to me that they've read any of those people, let alone Marx and Hegel, for example. And these genealogies are trotted out with extraordinary alacrity and ease. And then I look at them and I think, you don't know what you're fucking talking about, right? That this is madness. That if you look at someone like Amor Matala, right, who is taken as a representative of the crudities of political economy, he knows that there are readers who interpret things differently. This is no surprise. For God's sake, he was in Allende's Chile, struggling to get culture not to be sent out from the center, but to come from the periphery into the center. I mean, give me a break, right? So I do worry that there has come to be a canon based on the recitation of names in a quasi-biblical form, X begat Y, who begat Z, without a serious engagement with what those people are saying. So I have that element that's pessimistic. The other element is that, and you would know much more about this than me, I haven't lived there for so many decades, but that in Australia and to a certain extent in Britain, which have been important places for cultural studies, whole generations of people of our age have not taught in a classroom since the Cold War ended, thanks to the Australian Research Council, and whole generations of faculty who are almost ready to retire have never taught at all. Whereas, maybe you made it a bit too complicated, but you had to write lectures out for first generation in college distance students, right? Yeah. You had to get up in front of people who've been disenfranchised from the education system because of marriage
That
or
was a great
whatever.
thing about Murdoch University, that we were teaching people who would otherwise not have gone to university.
Not quite.
People like
Whereas,
Tom O'Regan, actually, who deferred entry so that he could come to Murdoch University.
or to Griffith. To Griffith in his case.
Oh, he came. Oh, am I?
So
Sorry. Yes, I'm mixing it up.
he deferred it. He would have gotten into University of Queensland.
You're right. You're right.
He took a year off because he wanted to go to this exciting new thing. And there were people like that at Murdoch too. I just don't know their names. But Tom ended up at Murdoch when we were there. Yes, so exactly. And I worry very much about this disarticulation of cultural studies from teaching. Because one of the things about teaching is that you actually do have to read these damn texts and tell people what they're about. So that's my pessimistic addition, Prof.
Yes, and of course, the interesting thing about teaching cultural studies, if you're working on popular culture, is that it's given that your students know so much more than you do about what you're talking about. So there's a whole art of teaching cultural studies, which, yes, I think a lot of our colleagues have missed out on.
I really worry about that. And there is also a reshifting of the equilibrium of power in the classroom when students know more than you do that can be really valuable. Our inner Freirians become excited and energized by such moments. So, Prof, thank you so much for doing this. It was lovely to reconnect. I have to ask, what's in that glass you've been sipping at quietly?
It's a not very expensive Scotch whiskey.
I wondered, I thought so. And then I thought it might be ginger ale. But given the hour where you are, I think it's probably something a little more interesting. I've got some simply sipping English breakfast tea.
Well, it's 10, what, 11, 11:30 in the morning for you.
Exactly.
You
So,
can go out
John,
and have lunch in a few hours, and then 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, you can have dinner.
exactly. There are now these new studies on diet that say that the way that the Mediterraneans do it is completely wrong for our bodies. I look around me, I think the bodies look okay, but I'm not that kind of doctor. So, Prof. Froh, it was wonderful. Thank you very much. We didn't go in depth into all your books, but we managed to talk about quite a few of them. And if there are listeners out there who are not familiar with that corpus of work, I'd strongly urge you to remedy the fact. But do read Marxism and Literary History, even if John slightly abjures it.
Thanks, Toby. Nice
It
to
was
talk to you.
wonderful. Cheers, John.
Cheers.